You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this Friday in the second week of Advent, and it has snowed here in Seattle. Other people go, yes, it does snow this time of year, but Seattleites are always filled with wonder when it snows because it does it so rarely here. So yesterday it snowed. We started out last night. I put a note up because we had an eighth of an inch of snow on the ground, and so civilization was starting to break down here in Seattle. People are running around in the streets with torches and pitchforks, looking for Californians that they can kill and eat, and especially the fat, succulent ones. Seattleites really go for the fat, succulent Californians when the weather turns like this. And and look, it's Stephen Gradonis. He's probably wondering what I'm talking about.
No, actually, I know what you're talking about. Yes. I'm still having cognitive dissonance, though, with the idea of fat, succulent Californians. Surely you're not saying that the movies have lied to me and that all Californians are slim and tanned and healthy looking, because I'm almost sure that they are, all of them.
Yeah, no, that's not actually true. We get the fat, succulent ones up here sometimes. They come in vacation, and but they were all eaten last night by panic-driven Seattleites who can't drive in the snow. So I put a note up on my Facebook saying, you know, all we've got to live on now are Doritos and the first season of The Muppet Show on DVD, and I had to go out and get salsa, and I put a note up saying, if I don't return, tell my family I love them very much. But I made it back.
This is the classic original Muppet Show, not the new Muppet Show.
No, not the terrible new Muppet Show, the classic one that
yes.
Really, you could pretty much just lock me in a room with the original Muppet Show on DVD. And then just like fling in some food now and then, and I would be fine.
I've tried to explain the Muppet Show to my children. Back in my day, grown-ups, children, old people, everybody, we would all gather around the television, and we would watch celebrities interacting with hand puppets for 30 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
And there was singing and sketches and you know, occasionally somebody
super corny jokes
from Sesame Street, and Mark Hamill came and did the show, and Gonzo was Darth Vader, and everybody, and they're all like, this is just because there were only three channels, right? We're like, no, it was really good.
It was a great show. Yeah, it's like, you just have to watch it, you know? I mean, how can people not appreciate the great, because it all still holds up, too. You know, it's just, it's magnificent stuff, the original Muppets. And I loved the Muppet movies. I loved the recent one with Amy Adams, you know,
yes.
She was having a great time in that movie. And you just can't go wrong up until they launched it again. And then all of a sudden it had to have like double entendres and, you know, this bitter, cynical Kermit the Frog. And it's like, well, what are you doing? You
know? It's hilarious. I mean, it's almost like the people in the people that were that were represented as the villains in the Muppet movie is a hard, cynical act for hard, cynical times. It's like they literally did take over the brand, and they gave us the Muppets instead of the Muppets. I think they put the Muppets on television. It's like,
although they're more like the Muppets. I mean, It's like, this is supposed to be fun, you guys. Tell me some corny jokes. I want to hear from Statler and Waldorf, you know? And oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But the original series, it's just solid gold. Nothing will ever tarnish it. It lives forever. And we have the first season on DVD, which, you know, in a pinch, such as in, for example, Seattle Snowstorm, we lay down a whopping, I think, like 2.5 inches of snow, although maybe that's extreme. Which is the kind of thing my just before I went on the air, my son called me and said, I tried to get to work today, but I couldn't do it because of the 2.5 inches of snow. It's Seattle is crippled. It's paralyzed with this terrible snow because we don't have, unlike you guys out east.
Yes.
We have like zero snow removal preparation stuff going on out there because it doesn't snow enough to justify it just gathering dust in some municipal parking lot.
It can't stop raining.
Right. Yeah. So, and it's going to start raining here pretty soon because it's already warming up. But, you know, so we got up and it was magical. Last night, I went and took a long walk around the neighborhood with my youngest son. My third son. It was snowing out. And we just said,
about how many sons you have there?
I get baffled sometimes, you know. And don't tell me that you don't, like, when you're trying to address your youngest son, accidentally say like the names of all your other kids before you finally
constantly.
Get to his name. I do this all the time.
Constantly.
Yep. When I was growing up, my name was Rick, Mike, Mark, whoever you are.
Yes.
That was my name.
Yes.
And, yeah. So anyway, it's we've had a magical snowy day, and that's probably it.
I am familiar with this phenomenon. It was kind of surreal to me because I grew up here in the Northeast. I grew up with, you know, big heaping mounds of fluffy snow that then turns into ugly brown slush, you know, and that was my life. And right. Of course, we always had snow plows and we always shoveled in the winter. And then my lady had gone to Charlotte, North Carolina to study nursing, and I moved down there because that's where she was. And I vividly remember that first winter in 1990 and the surreal experience of watching a straight-faced man on television, on an actual news show, saying the words, "It's getting pretty treacherous out there, folks. Our advice would be for everyone to just stay home." And it was I would almost hesitate to call it a dusting. but not only is there no snow removal infrastructure, people down there just have no idea how to drive in snow. It's like the other thing that they don't know how to do is they don't know how to make left turns because there are these beautiful wide roads with these turning lanes. You get into your turning lane and then you wait until it's perfect. Like here, you just have to kind of go for it. Yeah. And so nobody down there can drive in the snow and nobody can make a left. Although it actually is getting better because a lot of people from the north are relocating there. So.
Steve, you are singing the song of my people. that is what happened. You should see, Seattle is just like because of course it's all built on these sometimes extremely precipitous hills, especially when you get right down toward the waterfront, just ridiculous hills. And so Seattle just turns into this paralyzed skating rink with cars just left in the middle of streets and roads. Just, you know, people just get out of the car and walk away because there's just no hope. And I have a friend who a couple of years ago we had some snowstorm a few years back, and she lives in West Seattle. So just to give you the layout of Seattle a little bit, there's kind of the international area where the Safeco Field is, which if you've ever watched a sporting event in Seattle, you've probably seen Safeco Field. She worked down there for Amazon, and to get to to where she lived, which was in West Seattle, you had to drive like a couple of miles south and then go over this big, huge bridge and then drive a couple more miles in West Seattle to get there. She left her office because it started to snow in Seattle. She left her office at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and she got home at like midnight because nobody in Seattle knows how to drive. And so the whole thing just like instantly turned into this huge parking lot. There were people, I'm not making this up, there were literally people getting out of their cars and just pooping on the sidewalk because when you got to go, you got to go. And there was like, you're in this like super industrial area where there's no stores, there's no place you can go. And it was just like, it was like The Walking Dead. It was just civilizational breakdown in Seattle. And it snowed. It was like 3 inches of snow, you know?
Yeah.
So that's just kind of how it is here in Seattle. We experience civilizational breakdown every time it snows. So fortunately, I just work at home and never have to go anywhere. And so I'm just sitting here enjoying the beauty, watching the snow happen. And it's a glorious thing. But anyway, you probably didn't want to hear about all of our weather issues. But
oh, no, it's fine.
Oh, how's it going? How's
things? Well, it's going great. I had a really interesting experience last night, which I'm looking forward to telling you about.
Yes.
I've seen a couple of movies that we can chat about, and I've written a couple of blog posts this week, which have attracted some.
Oh, yes, that's right. You've been leading people into error and damnation.
I have. Both about...
I saw an angry tweet from Donald Trump about you. I forget where I read it.
Yes.
But, yeah. Or where I wrote it, perhaps, is more accurate. But I'd love to talk about that. We're going to get into some serious theological inside baseball, people.
Yes.
This is going to be really, really great. You're going to love it. So, but we can't do it now because the music of Ludwig von Beethoven is about to come crashing in, reminding us that... we have to take a station break in order to pay the bills. You are listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you are listening to me and Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about all kinds of things. And we'll be back right after this on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with arch heretic Stephen Gradonis with some crazy novel theory that is shocking St. Blogs and the interwebs today.
Let's go in chronological order and go back to my shocking and very upsetting blog post from December 6th from the feast day of St. Nicholas.
Okay.
And that pivotal moment in church history, that moment that lives alongside St. Francis of Assisi receiving the stigmata and Pope St. Leo the Great going out to stop the barbarian hordes and every other great moment in church history. And of course, I'm referring to the moment when St. Nicholas socked Arius in the schnoz at the Council of Nicaea for being a heretic and a jerk.
Right.
Every on social media, if you're a Catholic on social media, you know that this moment is most beloved.
It's actually a dogma of the church. In fact, the Council of Nicaea originally, the final clause,
yes,
after and life everlasting, there was another clause that said, "I believe Nicholas punched Arius out at the Council of Nicaea." A lot of people don't know that, but it's an actual dogma of the faith.
Well, and as everyone knows on social media, in Catholic land, on what we call Catholic Twitter, and I don't know if there's a Catholic Facebook per se. I don't know if on Facebook we talk that way, but in the Catholic circles on Facebook, there are these memes that circulate. Memes about Saint Nicholas punching Arius.
Right.
And
some of them are quite funny.
Some of them are quite funny. And I don't want to gloss. And I have been known to share one myself. Once or twice. Last year I shared a GIF of that was taken from an icon that just showed Nicholas slapping Arius, and he was, and of course it was on endless loop, so it was slap 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 slap.
Oh yeah, yeah, I saw that.
And
yep. The one that says, I came to give presents to little children and punch heretics, and I'm all out of presents.
Yes. And if you go to my blog post, an Eastern Orthodox gentleman who likes to make funny videos, a couple of years ago, recorded a unique rendering of an American classic that goes, "I saw Santa punching Arius." In fact, let's just listen to the opening lines of that. Give me a second here. Let's listen to this.
I saw Santa.
Can you hear that fly?
I can't. If you've got it on your computer, it's not going to play over the air.
Oh, man.
It's heartbreaking. I know. But, okay. You know, if I can. I think people can reconstruct it.
Go to the blog. Go to National Catholic Register and go to my blog and go to the blog post before the current one. And you can listen to it yourself.
There it is. Okay.
So anyway. Yeah.
So, probably just saves a copyright lawsuit anyway, so that's good.
I saw Santa punching Arius. So okay. I think last year I finally hit like peak St. Nicholas punching Arius, and I began to feel some concern about the prevalence of this meme. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was because of something in the political environment at the time, or if it's just me getting older and mellower, but the idea of celebrating an act of violence in defense of orthodoxy in this way, it began to rub me the wrong way.
Right.
And it seemed to me to bespeak not just a zeal for the faith, but an animus and a contempt for people with wrong opinions or wrong beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... And on the one hand, I get that people are...
You know why that bothers you? Because you're stupid and bad.
Well, certainly a lot of my... believe it or not, more than one person in the comm box intimated that perhaps I needed the Arius treatment myself. You might not believe that, but it's true.
But comm boxes are normally havens of rational discussion. How could these things be?
I want to give full credit to the meme as far as it goes, because on the one hand, it's true that we live in an age of hypersensitivity, and you've talked on...
We do not.
You've talked on Facebook more than once about people needing insensitivity treatment.
Yes, indeed.
You know, safe spaces and trigger warnings and microaggressions and all of that. And in the church, people are maybe sometimes to an exaggerated degree, but they have legitimate frustrations with the seeming unwillingness of some of our leaders to take unpopular stands and to clearly delineate what it is that the church teaches. And while I think that this phrase gets thrown around too much, I think that there is a legitimate criticism up to a point to be made of what some people disparagingly call the church of nice.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there are some problems. Right. So let's talk about the problems. First of all, St. Nicholas probably wasn't even at Nicaea. Sorry, folks. There are historical lists of the bishops that attended the council, and he's not on them. And there are no records that link him to the council for over half a millennium. Now, there are some people who are going to tell you that, well, he was there, but the bishops struck his name from the official records because he punched Arius.
Punched Arius.
And that it's possible that that story, the story of the punch, or the, it's not really a punch, the story of the violence, that doesn't come up for 1,000 years after, right, until after 1,000 years after Nicaea. So right, you know, when the bishop in question isn't linked to the council for half a millennium, and your story doesn't happen for a full millennium, and then when it happens, it's not Arius himself, but an Arian, and then that story's not good enough, and a couple of hundred years later, somebody revises it. No, it was Arius himself. You're on really shaky historical grounds here.
Right.
And then the other thing is, let's be clear, the story describes Nicholas slapping Arius, not punching him. Mm-hmm. And that's an important distinction because, you know, maybe in like 1940s Hollywood, a punch in the jaw could be a salutary way of, you know, knocking somebody back into their senses. And, you know, it's okay, I deserve that. Maybe in 1940s Hollywood movies, but in any other time, you might slap somebody to try to zing them back into their senses. But if you punch somebody, it's there's a wish to harm the person there, or an expression of contempt.
Right.
It's not the same thing.
Right.
So, and there is a Greek, there's a tradition in Greek iconography that shows this legendary slap, shows mm-hmm. St. Nicholas slapping Arius. There are no icons of him punching him. So this is American frontier culture. This is not like rugged, manly, pre-political correctness culture such as the world has known the world over. This is a product of a distinctly American fascination and being enamored with violence that
and particularly with violence, with redemptive violence, with the idea that you can really solve the world's problems with violence.
And that, I think, is there's a whole, and particularly in Christianity, this has been linked to muscular Christianity, and you see it in the love that some people have of the story of Jesus cleansing the temple.
Right.
A story which in some people's minds, and you can see, you go to their Facebook page, and the cleansing of the temple is splashed across their wallpaper. And it's
right.
This story embodies the gospel message. All the business about loving and praying for your enemies and turning the other cheek and overcoming evil with good, being gentle and not violent, 1 Timothy, not being quick-tempered or pugnacious, a soft right. answer, turning, all of that, that's like milksop snowflake Christianity. That's
Christianity
for wimpy liberal losers.
I have actually heard people argue mm-hmm. Both for torture and for capital punishment by saying torture is good because God the Father tortured Jesus to death and killed him, and therefore that makes torture and murder good. That makes torture and capital punishment good. And it's like, no, we tortured and murdered God the Son. God knew that we would do it, and
for redemptive,
and Jesus submitted himself to, he handed himself over to us, knowing what we would do. But that's, you know, it's a radical perversion of the faith,
especially, you know, yeah,
yeah. I mean,
consider that they didn't just. Jesus wasn't only tortured, he was murdered. So I guess that makes murder.
Murder is great, you know. Yeah, it's a really weird thing, but there is that, you can run into that kind of desperate perversion of the tradition. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis talking about the historical fact that St. Nicholas did punch Arius out at the Council of Nicaea. Actually, not a historical fact. In fact, there's zero evidence for it, really.
Yes. And there's a tradition in Eastern iconography that shows Nicholas slapping Arius. And this is venerated in the tradition for Nicholas's zeal for the faith. Although it should be noted that in the original story, Nicholas, after slapping an Arian, is deprived of his vestments and sent away in disgrace. And in a later version, he's actually thrown in jail. Although in that version, it should be noted that he is vindicated by our Lord and our Lady, who appear to him in jail and ask him, "Why are you imprisoned?" And he says, "For loving you." And so they give him an archpriestly garment and they give him a book, and the jailers come in, and of course they're astonished to find him there, which really raises the question, why was his name struck from the record again? I mean, he was vindicated by Jesus. So, yeah. But my concern is with people who write things like this. So this is a comment that I got in response to my blog post. We need men in the church, not boys. Saint Joan of Arc led soldiers into battle and people died at her private revelation from Christ. Heretics should be punched and slapped. Polite society in the United States is killing the church here. Bunch of turn the other cheek sissies.
Yeah.
And I just was like, wow.
Wow.
Turn the other cheek, sis. Like, Jesus' teaching embodies what is here the object of this person's contempt.
Right.
And Jesus says, you know, if you're my disciples, other people are going to hit you. You turn the other cheek. This person says, hit them before they hit you.
Yeah.
This is troubling to me.
It's a grave perversion of the faith, and it's everywhere. It is everywhere. I run into this all the time. It's a really distorted understanding of manhood, and particularly of Christian manhood. The Catholic tradition has always, actually, that's not true. The Catholic tradition for the first three centuries until the empire becomes Christian takes a radically pacifist approach to violence.
Yes.
The Gospels have, you know, they demonstrate that guy's attitude. It's what Peter does. Peter whips this sword out and cuts somebody's ear off. And he's ready to go on the attack and do all of those things. And Jesus says, put up your sword. And Peter learns his lesson. So when Peter writes his letters to a persecuted church that is being used to light Nero's gardens, human beings tied to poles, doused in oil and set on fire, that church that is undergoing what Peter calls a fiery trial, Peter's sole counsel to that church is be sure to die well.
Yeah.
That's what he tells them. He's don't sin. You know, whatever you do, as you face your martyrdom, do not sin in return. That's how the early church approaches things. And you don't start getting just war theorizing until the empire becomes Christian and the church has to start thinking about the common good for example, for people who are not Christian, how as fellow citizens. And that, but even then, what the church says basically is, if you have to, if you really absolutely have to, then use violence.
But this is something that is fundamental to the early Christian ethic, and it's rooted in Jesus' own example, which, you know, the incident in the temple aside, is defined by his nonviolent willingness to be abused and to be punished and to accept violence from others, right? And in his teaching, this is particularly clear in Luke's gospel. And Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, gives it a slightly different spin, but in Luke's gospel, it's very clear in the teaching on turning the other cheek that when Jesus says, if anyone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. If anyone compels you to go a mile, go with him 2 miles. If right. anyone requires of you your cloak, give him your. If anyone requires of you your jacket, give him your cloak as well. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Who was doing these things to Galilean Jews?
Right.
Who would compel you to go a mile? Who might requisition your clothing? Who might strike you in the cheek? Who was doing this to Galilean Jews?
The Roman occupiers.
And right. how did Jews feel about that? Well, there were two schools of thought. One of them was the violent school, the zealots. Let's take up arms. Let's resist the infidels. Let's throw them out. We'll bring the kingdom of God to earth. Yeah. Jesus rejects this.
Yeah.
He says, no. When these guys come and they slap your face, turn the other cheek. Do not follow the zealot's way. Don't take the way of violence. And, you know, in sharp contradistinction to another founder of major world religion a few centuries later, you know, he led no armed forces. He waged no war. He conquered no mortal enemies. He occupied no territories. The only violent death that he was involved in was his own. And the Gospels celebrate him precisely for accepting it willingly without protest or resistance. And it wasn't just him. You've the Acts and the other New Testament writings, they present persecution as the normative Christian experience. Mm-hmm. And throughout that, the New Testament advocates enduring rather than inflicting violence and even death as the normative Christian response.
Right. And so, you know, Jesus puts this in a way that the American church, would to God the American church would learn this verse. Jesus says, do not fear him who can kill the body. Fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. In other words, what Jesus warns of and what the historic Christian church has always said is that the grave danger to the church is not persecution. The grave danger to the church is seduction.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, I greatly fear that we are going to learn that lesson the hard way. Because, you know, your writer is not alone. That attitude is hugely popular in the American, especially in the American church.
But in my blog post on that subject, for a reason that I'm still not entirely clear on, one of my readers asked me, is Jesus a human person? I'm not sure where that question came from. And I gave that, you know, I believe like Jesus that a good question deserves a straight answer. And I replied that the classic theological formulation is that Jesus is a divine person with a human nature, but not a human person. And that's a little counterintuitive to some people, but I didn't expect someone to say, this was the reply that I got. Uh-huh. Sorry to differ with you, but you may have all the theological and media background listed in the side panel, but what the church has always taught is that Jesus was true God and true man. So yes, he was a divine person, but also a human person. Catechesis has suffered these past 50 years, so I do not blame you for this faulty view. It is so sad. Your statement above is heretical.
By the way, I screen capped the whole conversation. I'm starting a change.org petition to get you removed from the interwebs entirely because you're a danger to souls.
Yes. Well, this is an entirely reasonable and understandable thing to say. And because it stands to reason that if Jesus is a person who is both God and man, he has a human nature and a divine nature. He has a divine nature, so that makes him a divine person. If he's a person with a human nature, why shouldn't we call him a human person? It's logical, it's reasonable, and you can use language that way, but that's not how the church has historically expressed it. And there's a very specific reason why. It has to do with the way that the church has tried to get at what it is in Jesus that is one. And it, for that matter, what it is in the Holy Trinity that is three. And these attempts to say, how is it that Jesus is both God and man, but he's one? How is it that the God is one God, yet we also talk about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit? And this need to grapple with new concepts actually led to a philosophical development, the idea of person as distinct mm-hmm. from nature. This was a new concept.
Hypostasis.
Yeah. Is and we speak of the hypostatic union. The first time I heard hypostatic union, I thought it meant exactly the opposite of what it really does. I thought hypostasis meant nature, and so the hypostatic union was the union of these two natures. But no, the hypostatic union is the union of two natures in one person. And so the word person signifies what is one in Jesus. And when you actually start to try to understand the idea that Jesus has this human nature in its completeness, the idea that there's anything that's one in Jesus becomes very hard to understand. Let's get back to that when we get back
to it. By the way, I think that the hypostatic needle is a vaccination that gives you an electric shock at the same time, but that's just my theory. But yeah, we're almost up against the break, and Ludwig should come crashing in here in just a moment. There he is. We will be back here on Connecting the Dots right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about theological arcana and inside baseball and what it all means. We'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
The hypostatic union. So Jesus, when you actually start to ask yourself the question, why is Jesus one? It's a harder question to answer than you might think, because I think many of us, when we're kids, we kind of imagine the Son of God, the third person of the Blessed Trinity, kind of plugged into Jesus where the soul goes or where the mind goes, you know. But that turns out to be a heresy, Apollinarianism. And then when I was a young adult trying to figure out what was one in Christ, what it is in Christ that makes him one, I thought maybe the center of personhood is the will. So if Jesus is one person, then he would have only one will. But no, it turns out that's heresy too. It's called monothelitism. Jesus had a divine will and a human will. He has a divine person, but he also has a human soul, which in a human who's not God, the soul would seem to be the center of personhood, but he's got a divine mind and a human mind. And when you add all these things up, it becomes really hard to see how all of this human stuff in Jesus doesn't just add up to a human being who's separate from the second person of the Blessed Trinity. Even if you kind of crazy glue them together, how is it that this person who has a mind and a soul and a will, that he's not just – why aren't we Nestorians? You know, Nestorians basically distinguish the humanity and the divinity of Christ so thoroughly that, at least according to their critics, that the result was that Jesus is an amalgam of two persons, one human and one divine, which we know is wrong. But why is it wrong? And even how is it wrong?
Right.
And it reminds me of back all the way back when I was a Protestant and I was first writing to you and you wrote your book, This Is My Body. Mm-hmm. This question was nagging me about the Eucharist, that we say that the substance of the bread and the wine is gone and that only the accidents or the appearances remain. But when we talk about accidents or appearances of bread and wine, it turns out that what we mean is literally everything that we know of bread and wine. And when we say that the substance of the bread and wine is gone, when you try to pin down what the substance is, we don't know what it is. We can't pin it down. What is missing in the apparent bread and wine to make it not bread or not wine? Mm-hmm. And these are really interesting questions about Aristotelian metaphysics that I had to work my way through on my journey to the church. And we're not going to resolve them in the next few minutes.
Come on, we got 5 minutes. Chop, chop. Let's resolve all these.
but technically speaking, in the history of Catholic theology, the word person has been whatever it is that's one in the God-man Jesus. We use the history behind the fact that the church has used this language and that it has this particular formula or way of speaking.
The more you know. See, so it turns out you're not actually an arch heretic then.
Surprisingly so, at least not that I've discovered so far.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. I for one, am relieved because, the whole having to burn you at the stake thing was going to really cause a crimp in my calendar. I had other things I needed to do. So good.
Let me tease next week.
All right, let's talk about next week.
So next week, we're going to be talking about two huge movies. One of them is Rogue One, a Star Wars movie. And so I'll do my my Star Wars song and dance.
Okay.
And I really do have a song and dance. You just wait.
Is this like Cantina song and dance?
No, it's surprisingly not.
Okay. There's also that dancing girl in Empire Strikes Back, but I don't think I want to see that. at least not from you. So.
The other thing we're going to talk about is Martin Scorsese's Silence, which, of course, is an adaptation of the great Catholic novel by the Chinese Catholic Endo. And
Japanese.
Did I say yes?
You said Chinese.
Yes. Okay. Long day. Really long day. Anyway, Japanese. I was at Silence last night, and so was Martin Scorsese and a whole bunch of actors and other filmmakers. And they took questions from the audience, and somehow the moderator always called on – he called on the person sitting right next to me, but he never quite called on me. And then somebody from the back gave the high sign, and the moderator said, "I'm sorry, the time's over. We can't take any more questions." But Scorsese turned to me, and he pointed at me, and he said, "That guy really wants to ask a question." So I stood up and I took the microphone. I said, "Thank you." And I said, "Stephen Gradonis, National Catholic Register." And he blinked and he said, "Oh, I read you." And I was like, "Oh, well, thank you."
Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Well, I knew that he might recognize my name, and it was for a very difficult reason. You see, he probably first learned who I was from Roger Ebert. And he learned who I was from Roger Ebert because Roger Ebert credited me in an essay for his book on Martin Scorsese, in which he wrote, "I previously believed that the last temptation of Christ was not blasphemous, but I've been convinced otherwise by Stephen Gradonis, National Catholic Register." Scorsese reading this book and saying, "Who's Stephen Gradonis?" and looking at me. So I thought there was a possibility that when I said Stephen Gradonis, National Catholic Register, Scorsese, you might say, "You! Out of here!"
Seize him!
But he was actually very gracious to me. He gave me a great answer to my question. And he shook my hand afterward, and he said he enjoyed my reading. So that was a big deal for me in more
ways. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. Wow. Well, bravo. Well done. Now I'm going to be extra interested in what you've got to say about silence when we talk about it next week. Yep. So that is extremely cool. You know, I mean, I bet you felt like a human person after that.
Well, you might say that I felt divine, but not that I was a divine person.
All right.
And just to bring things full circle, I thought there was a real possibility that he might punch me in the nose.
Did you? Well, that's good. But what am I trying to say here? That experience of connection with somebody that you don't expect to be connected to in any way is often very strong. I've had this happen to me. I once had a bishop call me about something, mm-hmm. and I'm always shocked that a bishop has the slightest idea who I am, right? My own, I was at a parish somewhere, and my own bishop was at the parish, and I just, you know, he had given a homily, and all I wanted to do was just say, thank you. I liked your homily. And he like recognized me and called me by name. And I was like, dude, you've got a diocese of 350,000 people. Why would you know who I am? And that's a weird feeling, but of course it's always a gratifying feeling when somebody knows your name and recognizes that you exist. So well done. Bravo. You deserved it. I think that's super cool.
So it's a very challenging and interesting movie, much more so I expect than the other movie we're going to be talking about, although I hope that'll be fun too, and I'll be screening it on Monday, so...
Yeah.
Report on both movies.
You know, it's what can I say? A really good steak is good, but so is a bowl of whipped cream. You know, not everything has to be a steak.
By the way, I should throw out a quick plug. If you missed, we're currently in the middle of our holiday mini-series, mini-season of Real Faith. The one-hour mini-series premiere is tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern, and you can go to netny.tv and watch it live online at 8 o'clock Eastern. And watch for our other shows airing. If you go to decentfilms.com, just as soon as it gets back up, because it seems to be down at the moment, you'll get the full schedule there.
Very good. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today was Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back on Monday on Breadbox Media. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.